Going home at the end of life prolongs life.
Assessing your heart before surgery.
What is the best timing for hormone replacement therapy?
And does long-term antibiotic therapy help people with Lyme disease symptoms?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on April 1st, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start with the Lyme disease study that's in the New England Journal of Medicine? I think it's appropriate to start with that because it's spring here on the East Coast. Lots of people getting outside and increasing their exposure to ticks. Found to carry Lyme disease in most parts of the country, actually.
And we know that antibiotic therapy can be effective in treating people that have acute Lyme disease. However, about 10 to 20% of patients that are treated continue to have lingering symptoms, things like fatigue, musculoskeletal pain, sleep disruption, and cognitive dysfunction. And the question has been, does long-term antibiotic therapy help these symptoms, which have been attributed by many people to persistent Lyme disease? So what this study did was, in a randomized, placebo-controlled way, they took 281 patients that had persistent symptoms. All patients got 2 weeks of antibiotic therapy and then randomized for 12 weeks to either placebo or to one of two other antibiotic therapies, the combination of clarithromycin and hydroxychloroquine. The other group received doxycycline, and then they assessed their quality of life. And what they discovered was all three groups had some improvement of symptoms over the next 3 months, but there was no difference between the groups. And by the way, when they looked at it at the end of a year, it didn't seem to improve symptoms either.
This is good news, of course, because so many people have been put on these long-term antibiotics, and we know that those are not without consequence just on their own.
About two-thirds of these patients who received prolonged antibiotics had some type of a reaction, mostly minor, for example, a rash. However, I must say, Elizabeth, this issue has been plaguing physicians and patients for years. This is not the first trial that's shown that prolonged antibiotic therapy hasn't been beneficial. Oftentimes, we treat these nonspecific symptoms as persistent Lyme disease. Sometimes there are other causes, and we just never look for them.
And hopefully also just take a prompt course of antibiotics if Lyme disease is established as a primary diagnosis and then be done with that.
Good advice.
Okay. From here, since we're in NEJM, why don't we stick with that? This issue, again, a long-term issue that's been out there in the literature for a very long time. What about hormone replacement therapy, HRT? Does it help? When should we start it? How long should it continue? Does it really benefit cardiovascular disease?
And again, this has been controversial because some very early prospective cohort studies, that is, you compare individuals that have been taking hormone replacement therapy to those that haven't, suggested that there was a 50% lower risk of coronary heart disease in postmenopausal women that took hormone replacement therapy. Fast forward to the randomized control trials in which women were provided estrogen, and not only did it not help, but it suggested that hormone replacement therapy actually increased the risk of stroke and heart disease. The thought being, well, maybe these women received it later. The timing of when it's administered, either early or late in menopause, is really important. So to address that, investigators embarked on what was called the ELITE trial, the early versus late intervention trial with estradiol. It was a single center trial, 643 postmenopausal women who had no known heart disease were stratified as to when they received estrogen replacement therapy, either early, less than 6 years of menopause, or late, more than 10 years. They measured the thickness of the carotid artery, what's called the carotid intimal medial thickness. And they followed these women for 5 years, and here's what they discovered. The women who received hormone replacement therapy early had less thickening of the carotid artery than the women who received it late. Now, I want to take a step back and remind you and our listeners, this is a surrogate endpoint. There are many things that contribute to stroke or heart disease. Thickening of the artery is only one of them. And unfortunately, these studies didn't really address the issue of whether early or late hormone replacement therapy actually changed the risk of cardiac disease or stroke.
Most of the women I know, of course, use HRT to manage the symptoms of menopause, suggesting that if that's the case, it will be initiated early in any case.
And that's a whole different ball of wax. We're using hormone replacement therapy not as primary prevention for cardiac disease, but for the symptoms that you mentioned. And that's a whole different issue.
Right. But I would also kind of push back on you and say, given that the cardioprotective issue aside, if women are going to initiate it, why not initiate it for that period of time, take it for as short a period of time as possible, and then stop?
That's what most healthcare providers are recommending. So you want to do it for the shortest period of time possible, because we really don't know the full side effects. So I agree with you, Elizabeth.
Okay. Since we're talking about the heart then and heart disease risk, let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine. This idea that everybody goes in for this assessment previous to surgery, a lot of times things are found that are heart abnormalities. Well, what happens then?
We all want to make surgery as safe as possible. So the real question is, how do you assess someone's risk and how do you minimize the risk that they're going to have heart problems when they have surgery not related to their heart, what is called non-cardiac surgery? This is a really interesting study. This is an observational study that looked at two different databases, a cath database, what sort of heart procedures did people undergo prior to surgery? And secondly, how did that affect their treatment? So they looked at over 190,000 individuals that were going to have non-cardiac surgery that ended up in a cardiac cath lab. And they said, gosh, how often were these patients symptomatic? And secondly is, did it result in procedures that otherwise would not have been performed? And the interesting thing is that about 3/4 of these patients that had the procedure either had no symptoms or very atypical symptoms. That tells me we're doing cardiac catheterization on a lot of people that otherwise would not have had it. And you say, well, why did they have it? Well, because they had an abnormal stress test. Approximately half of those ended up having a procedure done, bypass surgery or a stent being placed, that wouldn't have been done under normal circumstances, that was prompted to try to make the surgery safer. Did it make the surgery safer? Well, this particular study didn't address that, but previous ones have suggested that revascularization beforehand doesn't make the procedure any safer, doesn't make the non-cardiac surgery any safer with regard to heart disease. So I found this quite disturbing.
Right. It's back to that old issue of over-treatment once we found something incidentally.
And this is partly driven by the guidelines, because the guidelines say, if you really can't assess the risk, go ahead and do a stress test. If the stress test is positive, proceed with a cardiac catheterization. And then from there, once we see blockage, we feel like we have to do something to make the non-cardiac surgery safer, when in fact, there's no evidence that doing so actually makes it safer. I agree with you. I think we need to readdress the guidelines. I think we're giving poor advice to the physicians taking care of these patients.
And it's got to be directed to the physicians, Rick, because you know very well that any patient who hears, wow, you know, we've found this finding that is a little distressing in your heart, suggesting that maybe the blood flow isn't as good as it could be, that patient doesn't hear anything else with regard to, we want to put you on very good medical management or anything else relative to their surgery.
You're right. That patient feels like, gosh, I've got to have some procedure done to get rid of this blockage to make my surgery better. And you can sit down until you're blue in the face and say, well, we don't have any good evidence for that. But their mind's made up.
No question, we'll be talking about this one again. Finally, let's turn to the one that's nearest and dearest to my heart, and obviously the one I will also be writing about in the blog. That's in the journal Cancer, a look at a large number of patients, some of whom went home at the end of life and some of whom stayed in the hospital, and wow, what happened there?
And specifically, if you go home, is your survival worse than if you stay in the hospital? Now, this was a very interesting study because it was a study done in Japan that wasn't specifically designed to address this question. This study was designed to assess what are all the factors that we take into account to determine how long this person's going to live. But as a result of that, they had a number of patients that actually were in the hospital and a number of patients that were sent home, and it allowed them to compare the survival. They said, does going home shorten your survival? And in the patients who were projected to live for days, they actually lived longer at home than they did in the hospital. For those that were projected to live for weeks, they lived longer at home. And for those that were projected to live months, the survival was the same. So what this tells me is that allowing patients to be at home, and many of us want to be at home, does not shorten or decrease your survival. This despite the fact that the patients in the hospital were more likely to get IV fluids and more likely to receive antibiotics, but it didn't prolong their survival.
This is a good news study, and I'm happy to focus on this one because we're both aware that when somebody's in the hospital, they're getting poked and prodded, their sleep is disrupted, they don't feel that they're in control of their environment. Wouldn't it be just so much more peaceful not to be in the hospital environment, which is frequently tumultuous?
And as the caregivers and family members, we oftentimes feel guilty. We feel like if we're bringing them home, we're not providing all the advanced care and therapy. Bringing the patients home can give them a better quality of life and a longer life as well.
This is clearly a place where patients and families are going to need to advocate for themselves in order to make this change happen.
Yeah, this is the kind of care that I would personally want to receive, and also for my family members to receive as well.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Happy April Fool's Day. In previous years, we've done an April Fool's one. This year, we're not. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.